That's the signal.
Okay. All right. Welcome, everyone, to the January 4th, 2023 meeting of the Clark County Developmental Disabilities Advisory Board. I would just like to let you all know that this meeting is being audio recorded, and it will be saved and posted on the Clark County website, on the Clark County grid. So if any of you would like to go back and listen to this meeting, you are more than welcome to do that. And so when we look at our agenda for the evening, our first order of business is do we have any community input? I'm looking for hands, but I'm only seeing a couple of hands up. All right, so I'm not seeing any hands up, which means we might not, but yet.
I think Darla looks like she's coming on.
The virtual handout. Thanks for you, Darla. I know you might have some nugget for us. I'm sorry. You're there with your hand up and I'm not.
Yeah, I'm struggling to figure this out. Anyway, I just wanted to... Happy New Year, everybody. I wanted to announce that starting next week, Peace is doing a 7-week sexual health training for adults with IBD. And so that's going to be a new and wonderful training. There's also additional meetings that happen for the families and the guardians as interested. So if anybody wants additional information on that, please give me a call. And then in February, we're going to be doing a training on universal design with Monica Meyer, which will be phenomenal as well. So those are the trainings that we've got coming up. There's lots of legislative stuff, but I'll talk about that later in the meeting. So thank you so much.
Just one quick question. So like if any of our students that are in transition programs, would this be something appropriate for them?
I believe they need to be over the age of 18.
18 or older, okay. And do we know who the trainer is?
Yes, the trainer is Austin, and I'm not remembering his last name, from Planned Parenthood, and they actually created a curriculum specifically for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And so it's really focused on sexual health and how to stay healthy in all sexual aspects. So I will send you a flyer if you're interested, and I'll send it to Trish so you can send it out to the board, and it can go out to anyone who might be interested.
Thank you. Does anybody else have input for the good of the order?
Looks like Angela has a hand raised.
Yeah, I got that one. Thanks, Angela.
Sure, I'm wondering, we had two people join us on the phone, and I'm hoping to find out who they are. There's a 241-2280 number.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi, my name is Gabriela Ewing. I am joining from my phone because I'm driving. I'm sorry. I'm off to get the conversation, but I'm home.
Oh, and, thank you.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you. And then there's also a 980-8930.
If you are muted on the phone, it's *6 to unmute.
It doesn't look like they're muted. Not sure. Hello? If they can hear us or not. Oh.
Yes.
Yes. This is Amy Campbell. I had to join from my phone because I could not get my computer to work. And then now I'm transitioning to my mother's house. So I'm so sorry. This is Amy Campbell, special education teacher, joining over the phone.
Thanks, Amy. And thanks, Gabriella. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Yeah. Thank you both. Sorry to out you like that, but we need to keep a record of our participants. Okay, so any other community input? I am not seeing any hands. So we will go ahead and move on. Martha, Mayor, is she here?
Yeah, Maya.
I'm sorry, I did your name wrong. So you have a presentation for us on housing.
She's making her way up, and Angela is going to share online the PowerPoint that Martha put together as she does her presentation.
Yeah. For our phone participants, we need audio description.
Okay.
Well, she'll be talking, too.
Okay. Well, and if you've got a computer, you can access it from your website, right? You posted it there.
We do have it on the website, so that will be available for download and reference after the presentation as well, correct? Okay.
So my name is Martha Meyer. Thank you for having me. I'm here to talk a little bit about housing and IDD at Trisha's invitation. So you can do the first slide, I guess. Oh, can I see them?
Sorry, I'm just having a bit of technical issue, but I promise it'll be up in just a moment.
Okay.
And if you can't get it for whatever reason, Angela, I can always pull it up too. We had the power go out at our Center for Community Health today, and you know, with the wind, I think that it might be wreaking havoc on lots of different systems. So it sounds like we're all in it together at least.
That's not one thing, it's something else, right?
It seems to have really frozen for me, so I'm going to, oh, it's blinking now.
I've got it up.
So, Sister, now you're muted.
I realized that after. Okay, there it goes.
Okay.
Thanks, got it.
Okay.
It persevered.
Okay, I can see it too. So do the title slide. This is my introduction. So I'm Martha Meyer. I'm a parent advocate. I'm the convener of the Housing Committee of Peace, and also I was the Persons with Disabilities advocate for the Clark County Housing Options Study Project Advisory Group, known as PIG Project Advisory Group. And I was thinking about, you know, how long have I been involved in or interested in IDD housing? Go back about 10 years when my son was done with his transition program. And we thought, oh yeah, you finish transition and then you move out. Well, we realize it's not quite that simple. So you have to create the situation before you move out. And things are happening. It's exciting. So, second slide. So, of course, I think as we all know, the problem is there's not enough housing. Not enough housing for people with IDD, not enough housing for anyone. So it's a problem throughout the country, I think, as most of us know. Recently, there was a report to the legislature on IDD housing, And you can see a graph from that report. Some of this stuff may want to come back a little bit more closely. But if you turn to the next slide, a few highlights from that report is it pointed out that the DDA does not have a strategic plan for housing. Depending on how you figure it, there may be 37,000 adults with IDD facing housing insecurity in our state. And you can read that to see the assumption they make to come up with that number. And then I think, as we know, that many IDD individuals are below 15% of the area median income. So they're lower than extremely low income. So that makes it hard to afford housing. So back in January 2021, I joined this Housing Options Study Project Advisory Group. And there you kind of have the charter. The idea was to, again, you know, the county was grappling with lack of housing. And so they brought a group together. And they were really good about trying to get a spectrum of people to come up with some ways to address the housing shortage. And it wasn't just for low-income people, it's across the spectrum. So I applied and became a part of that group. So if you turn to the next page, in the next slide, yeah, there were 18 members of the program advisory group. And again, they tried to get a good cross-representation. It wasn't just housing developers, but a variety of people. And then there's a graph with a schedule. As I say, we started in 2021. I think we met about 10 times. If you find the slides online and then download them, in the notes there are links to a lot of these reports if you want to go into more depth. So the next slide. So on May 17th, 2022, the Clark County Council unanimously approved the action plan that we came up with. And if you want to read all 306 pages of it, again, you can find it online. Most of those pages are appendices, so that helps a little bit. But lots and lots of suggestions. And so one of the first things, things we did is come up with some objectives for developing the different housing strategies that we would come up with. And those are listed on this slide. So one of them was to encourage housing development that meets the needs of middle-income households. Another one was to support the development of housing that is affordable to low, very low, and extremely low-income households. They wanted to encourage diversity in housing types, including expanding middle housing options and increasing multifamily feasibility. They wanted to encourage the creation of a broad range of housing sizes and to make sure that they matched the need of the types of households in our area. And they wanted to focus on a 1 to 2 person household because, like other places, we're an aging county. And as people get older, they need smaller places, not larger places. And they wanted to make sure that housing was accessible to services and transportation. So either building it close to services or transportation, or bringing transportation and services to the housing. So if you turn to the next slide. So again, there were many, many strategies we came up with. We spent a lot of time honing them and deciding which ones to move forward. We kind of ranked them according to which ones were low cost, medium cost, or high cost, which ones were short term, medium term, and long term, and then the amount of effort, medium effort, low effort, high effort. And there's a grid, and also what income level that they would impact. So some of the strategic items that we came up with, I listed on this slide. And again, that they were just, you know, we got all these ideas and went back through and kind of evaluate them and organize them. So, you know, one idea was to reduce minimum lot sizes so you could build more houses. And again, a lot of it was a strategy to make sure that the public would not get upset about these recommendations. So yet, instead of rezoning things so you could get more housing in a certain area, they decided to keep the zoning the same to suggest that you redefine what can be built in that zone. They wanted to expand middle housing, and there's a definition of middle housing over to the left, but it's basically, we in most cities have a lot of single-family detached dwellings and a lot of apartments, but that middle area with quadplexes, duplexes, triplexes, cottage, housing townhomes, there's not as much of that available. And that's housing that people in middle income range are better able to afford. So that's a particular area that we wanted to expand. Always a lot of argument about housing, I guess, in these type of discussions, or parking, sorry, in these type of discussions. And we made some suggestions that perhaps certain type of housing, they could have less parking than is currently mandated. To encourage ADUs, which is accessory dwelling units, to make sure there's some protection of mobile and manufactured home parks, because these are more affordable housing. They wanted to, I think we recommended adopting a visitability program, which is something I hadn't heard about before, but a visitable house is one that's accessible to visitors. So the whole house isn't necessarily accessible, but you make a house visitable, you have, you know, zero, no steps, what do they call it? Or no step barrier-free entrance, and then you have a bathroom on the main floor that's accessible. So again, encouraging houses with visitability, which again makes lowers limitations to people. Okay. So the next slide. But I don't know if I just I'm gonna ship it up and it will be. So and some of the other strategies were redefining the definition of a household to remove the numbers of unrelated persons that may define a household. I don't know what the current definition is actually, but I think the idea was that so a number of unrelated roommates could live together and share costs. And also wanting to adopt housing affordability metrics as part of the next comprehensive plan update. And I think that's something the state is now mandating. We talked about allowing more residential uses in commercial zones. In some places, zone commercial, there's no commercial enterprise that wants to go in. So we talked about what could we put housing in those areas, or could we combine housing and commercial? So there's some talk about that. We wanted to review impact fees and figure out if these could be reduced, especially for affordable housing. Look at a county tax increment financing tool like the city has that would go to affordable housing. And then there's a strategy to work with aging and disability advocates to develop a universal design program. Sounds like PISA's already working on that. So, and I know at some point, Trish or somebody had me a brochure, there was some work done on universal design. But again, I think the more we raise that, and more people might be thinking about developing housing. Especially if we're talking not just housing for those with IDE, but those for seniors. they also need low barrier housing. So the next slide. Okay, these were just some of the random thoughts I was thinking about. Well, what did I get out of this, or what did I contribute to this process? One of the things that was clear early on is that we had to be kind of savvy to make sure whatever recommendations we came up with would have public support and the counselor's support, and that's why you don't talk about making areas more dense. You talk about expanding housing options. And then again, parking, you have to be real careful about, because if you try to limit parking, there's, I guess, a group of people that will get upset saying, well, you know, if you limit parking, then they're going to need, you know, parking in all sorts of really good places. So, sometimes it seems like, the mandate for parking is more than you really need, especially if you have people taking buses or non-drivers. But again, there's a real concern that if you lower the parking standard, we come up with a parking mess. So I think it's clear that there's an overlap between the needs of seniors and those with IED, and so I assume, you know, we need to continue to work with those that are dealing with aging issues and housing for those who are older. I guess I hadn't really realized until I got involved with this group. I mean, there's a lot I didn't know about housing. But that zoning is a way to discriminate. It used to be there was redlining, right? And we don't do that anymore. But when you have a lot of single-family detached dwelling lots, those are very expensive, and so it keeps lower-income people out of the neighborhood, which makes a very homogenous neighborhood. And then again, I think those that show up to zoning meetings and continue to push for a lot of single family lots are probably those who live in those, in that type of housing. As far as being the advocate for persons with disabilities, I'm not sure I have a lot of specific input other than, I think it's just helpful, to have someone there representing people with disabilities, because then at least other people think about it. I did suggest that they put a couple of documents in their library, including a report that CUNY funded on housing for those with IED. And again, I think some of the benefit of projects like this is just building relationships, you know, learning more. And then one of the fun little bits was I got to go on a field trip to Wolf Industries, and they're the folks that build some of the tiny homes in this area. Very cool. Very cool factory. It was particularly fun when we were in one of the houses, and suddenly the house started moving down the assembly line. It took me a while to figure out what's going on. So are there any questions about, I'm going to move on then to the Peace Housing Committee, but are there any questions about this housing advisory group?
Martha, I have a question. So I think that there was a timeline that you showed earlier on in the presentation, but it's been a while since the group completed the report. Do you know what's happened with that report and kind of some of the outcomes are... is the county taking action based on the recommendations?
They're supposed to be taking action. I think they were going to start with some of the ones that were low effort with a minimum timeline, just to get a jump start on things. I think there are supposed to be, you know, we talked about accountability, and there's supposed to be some reports. I haven't seen any of those yet. I think they are looking at some of the zoning things and have the folks talking about zoning changes. But I get the sense that those are very difficult changes to make.
I have another question for you. Of the recommendations, and I know it was 306 pages of a report, but were there any that you particularly thought were particularly beneficial to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families that this board and other interested parties might want to keep an eye on, or or
those are the ones
inform
that
themselves
on the on site number 7. And I didn't give you, I think they're all numbered and everything, and I didn't include the numbers. But I think, again, it would be good to, I wonder if you go to the website and get on a mailing list to see, you know, as they send out, see if they send out reports, because I know that was something that was a concern to the group, that it couldn't just become another report on the shelf.
Yeah, we will link the report in the meeting materials so that if people want a kind of quick way to get to it, we'll have it on our website too.
And if I hear of meetings that you can give input to, I will try to let you know and get the word out. And along the way, they've been really good about having opportunities for community input, a lot of stakeholder meetings, surveys, and all that. So I assume they'll continue to do that. But then I want to talk for a few minutes about the Peace Housing Committee. So that's slide number 9. So again, back in January 2021, we've been talking about this for a long time, and I've been with Darla's for quite a while. The Peace Board approved the formation of a committee to raise the concerns of people who have experienced IDD in conversations about affordable housing and to advocate for more housing options for those with IDD. So we pulled together, again, a variety of people from the Peace, Darla was there, parent advocates, housing people, Clark County DD people. So again, a variety of folks that were interested in housing. And then if you look for the next slide, we meet, we initially met a couple times a month, but now we're meeting once a month or less. And again, we're a fairly new committee, so we're still, I guess, kind of defining ourselves. But again, a lot of it is just information sharing. You get together and people talk about what openings they know are available for those with IDD, and you know, the case managers say, oh, are they, you know? And there's not really a good central clearinghouse for keeping track of housing for those with IDD. So I think we've talked about the need for that. I think our big win is that through the work of Andy Silver from the Vancouver Housing Authority, he was able, we knew that we wanted either like a affordable housing project for people with IDD, but because kind of best practice is not to congregate people with IDD into like one apartment, but to scatter them throughout the community, he suggested it might be better just to have vouchers, and we didn't think that we could get vouchers designated to our population. But he came up with a way where, I don't know the technical term, maybe Darla does, where Peace is able to recommend people for up to 25 housing vouchers. So that really is huge. But I know that Seattle has a, it prioritizes people with IDE for their housing vouchers. And I've talked to Pam Latin up there about, well, how can we do that? She said, oh, I don't think we can do it. We have some special, they had some problems up there. And then the Housing Authority ended up providing a lot of vouchers to the IDE community. But the fact that we have these 25 vouchers, I think, is huge. And hopefully this will continue. We were all disappointed when the Build Back Better bill didn't get through because there was going to be a lot of money in that for housing. Another thing we've done is met with Shen Feng, who works for the state as the Accessible Affordable Housing Program Manager. So that's a good connection to have. So we've learned things from him, and he's learned things from us. And then, and one of the fun things is, you know, people can call us up and want to meet with us. So I think in Samantha, is it Woodley? Call you, Trish. She wanted to come meet with our group because she was working on the next tax levy for affordable housing that the city is putting up for a vote. And we were able to tell her that some people in the IDD community live on SSI, and you know that's around $800. I'm not sure the current amount. Which means that if you talk about a third of that going to housing costs, it's very little money to provide housing. So she wasn't really aware of the need for this deeply affordable housing. So once we kind of informed her, she said she was going to go back and make sure that that was included as part of the plan for the next affordable housing tax levy. So that was kind of exciting. And then the next slide. So that's what the committee has done. But meanwhile, Case has really developed a housing arm. And they've hired Darcy Ladwig as a Peace Housing Coordinator. And the housing arm is called Home. Housing Options Must Exist. But Darcy lives in Spokane, so she does her work remotely. But she's also beginning to do housing work in Spokane, and they're starting a housing committee like our housing committee. So we've had some expansion. And again, if you want to know what they're doing, the best thing to do is go to the Peace website. They have a page on housing resources. And, I haven't been there for a while, but they have quite a lot of resources listed there, so that's a good place to begin. Have you begun roommate matching yet, Darla? I don't know where you're at.
We're ready to start right now. So through the Dan Thompson Memorial Grant, Partners for Housing was granted so many grants to help individuals across the state be able to do the free roommate matching. And it went live right at the end of December. So we now can help individuals connect with roommates one-on-one and build our pool of roommates here in Southwest Washington. We've actually already been doing that informally and have been able to match the roommates even without Partners for Housing just through some of the other things. One of the things that Martha touched on briefly is that looking at where all the housing trust fund units are, through the committee work that Martha and all the amazing volunteers have been doing, we've been able to identify where those units are, and we've been able to help fill those units across the county as well. So in addition to those 25 waivers that we've got through the Vancouver Housing Authority, we've actually been able to go back and work with the partners to fill the Helping Trust Fund units. So we've been getting quite a few people placed. It's quite exciting. But we've got enough roommate matching scholarships for anybody that would like to do that in Southwest Washington. So that would be wonderful.
And that's the service, I think, that they charge $300 or $400 per person?
It typically is $500 per person, okay. And it's free with these scholarships.
Okay. So that's really significant. So again, so what Peace is doing is helping people set up their own, what we might call a shared living situation, where you've got to find roommates, you've got to find a place to live, you got to be able to afford it. And so they'll help put together all the resources that you need to be successful in living in your own home. And we've also applied for Dan Thompson grants that would help fund buying houses. We may actually provide for a technology library and more housing navigation. We talked about partnering with AbleLight, which used to be called Bethesda. They're hoping to offer supportive living and more here in Clark County. And as of October 11th, so these are old figures, there were 7 adults with IDD who were in the pipeline to get a voucher, or there was one person who already had one, and 20 or 25 people that Peace was serving through their housing program. And again, that may have changed by now. So I think, and then Darla just mentioned the Housing Trust Fund. So we got some good news there that from Shane saying that this year, for 2022, the Housing Trust Fund is going to provide funding for 65 affordable IDD units. And that's compared to 2021, when there's only 8 IDD units. So one of the things they're discovering as the state looks into this is that there's Housing Trust Fund money, but it's very hard to access for IDD projects for a variety of reasons. They're not, usually IDD projects are not real large scale. You need a lot of technical expertise that, you know, if you're just doing a few little projects, you may not have. And so they're looking at ways to get more Housing Trust Fund money spent on IDD housing, which is great. So again, you know, it's also good to monitor what's going on at the state level. You probably know this, a good way to do this is go to the Art of Washington's website and click on their advocacy link. And they have at least one paper on housing for people with IDD. They've got advocacy dates coming up, and the one on January 25th will focus on housing. So again, the thing that I'm learning is that we need to keep on educating people about the need for housing for those with IDD, let our representatives know, our counselors, and just let our friends know. I think a lot of people don't realize that there's really no plan. So if you meet a new friend, let them know that there's a need for housing. So again, questions, or, you know, again, Darla, is there anything you want to add on what he's just doing?
I think you did an excellent job, Martha, and I just want to say publicly, Martha has chaired this committee since its inception, and she has just been a phenomenal advocate in carrying this issue forward. So thank you, Martha.
Well, thank you, Darla, and a little bit of mutual admiration. I appreciate all you've done on this issue, too.
All right. Thank you so much, Martha. That was a lot of information to digest, but you did it in a nice format where we can also go back and revisit it, too. All right.
Thank you.
I don't see any questions from Martha, and so we are going to, come on, Lindsay. We are going to move to our next agenda item. We have Peggy DeSalle here to talk about Safe and Home. Hi, Peggy.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to everybody. And I just want to say that the housing presentation was amazing, Martha. You can tell that you are super passionate about that and so knowledgeable. So it was just wonderful to hear all of the updates on everything that's going on, especially with your committee. So I really appreciated that. Well, as Susan said, my name is Peggy DeSalle, and I am with Safe and Home, which is a remote support service that is now not so fairly new anymore in the state of Washington. We've been here for over a year and a half now, and are currently serving about 70 people in the state, which has been super exciting to see the growth of this service. And I'm actually going to do a quick presentation for you, just so you can learn a little bit more on remote support. So let me just get my slideshow going here. Okay, can everybody see that okay? Terrific. Okay, super. First of all, I just want to say thank you to Trish and to everybody here for allowing me to come and help educate you. There is still a lot of people that don't know this service exists for the IDD community. And it is, it's just another way of supporting people who, you know, don't necessarily want in-home care or don't require in-home care or that would like and would benefit from really utilizing both. We help people that are still living at home. We help people that are living alone or with roommates. And what it allows them to do is really, stay independent or gain their independence. And it's really something I'm super passionate about and find myself just absolutely fortunate every single day that I get to be the messenger, especially in Washington State, for this service. I'm going to play a quick video. This is Alex Cosmo, who is our remote support trainer. So he works with our remote support staff on a daily basis. And I'm just going to have him give you his brief explanation on what remote support is.
My name is Alex Kappa. I am the remote support training manager here at Safe at Home. The remote support team is a bunch of people who believe in a very powerful proposition: independent living, dignity, full partnership in the game of human being for everyone that we work with in every capacity, both here at Safe at Home and in life. That proposition gives you a really powerful way of being while you're working with someone. Whatever struggles they may have going on, you know, X or Y or Z happening in their home life, and you get them on the line, it's an opportunity to fulfill on that proposition by being really curious, wanting to know what's going on with them, and leaving them with a sense of, hey, I stand for you and your independence, and I've got your back. If something happens in the home, you can give me a call. You got something on your chest you need to get off? You can give me a call. And there's a team full of people in this building, and they are all here for you in the exact same way. The goal of remote support in general is to help the individuals we support live independently, live lives with self-determination, and live lives with dignity. When we work with somebody on remote support, we're working pretty much any circumstance in life. Whether somebody's in their 20s and living on their first place alone, or in their 30s, you know, living with family, or in their, you know, 50s or older, living with roommates in a home that they share out in the community. So our goal is to meet them wherever they are and help provide services that'll next level their independence and decision making, and give them the skills and support to go from where they are now to where they want to be in a relatively low-touch way. They get to experience privacy, doing it for themselves, and knowing that they have the backstop of, if they really run into something, remote support is there. It's also there for passive things. One of the obstacles to independence may be something like a risk of falls or some other passive danger. Remote support uses sensors and other electronic tools to help detect patterns of activity and minimize those sorts of risks. My name is...
So that is, you know, a very brief description of really what remote support is all about. And I'd like to show this slide because I know that, you know, collectively here, we really, you know, are working all very closely with the IDD community. And, you know, with, there's a lot of people that really aren't aware of how people are actually treated really on a daily basis. Like, you know, what if you were always treated like a child or never really got to make your own decisions on what you were going to wear or where you were going to live or what time you were even going to go to bed? Or the only risky thing you could do was act out, or you just never really got to make a mistake. Let's say you burnt popcorn in the microwave, you know, one time, and you just never got to use the microwave after that again. These are some of the things that people in the IDD community experience on a daily basis, and what we try to do is really help them gain that independence back. So we are really keeping the promise of following the HCBS guidelines and follow the you know, what is important to the individual, what is important for the individual, and what does the individual really want, and where do they want to go within their life. And so how do we do that? Well, we do that by empowering people in the community to live independently in their own homes and out in the community using our remote support staff and assistive technology. I'm so proud to show you this next video. This is actually one of our very own Washingtonians, Brian, who is on using Safe at Home services right now, and I'm just going to let him tell you his story.
Hi, memories of him are still here, and there is this part everywhere. I miss him. I loved him. I was not close to him. Because the day he died, finally tore a heart to him. And they were buried.
Brian was put on the core waiver for supportive living services when his father passed away. His father was his primary caregiver, and Brian loved him very dearly. And so when he passed away, he was left without anyone to really provide that care he received his whole life. As can happen with people with disabilities in smaller towns that don't have programs like supported living, he was put in an old folks home, and that was very difficult for him.
I went out of policy. I went and told him whatever I wanted. They went to the wild west all the time. And that was the toughest nightmare. The point where I said, I'm not a legal person.
He was there, from my understanding, approximately 3 years. He fell into a trap that we actually see far too commonly in the line of work, where he was exploited for his funds, but I know very painful for him about that.
I spent my whole entire life moving from here. All places I moved to, I never, in my whole entire life, I never had a stable place to go. Ever. I never had a stable life. And then a whole year in hotel before I came home.
So we had gotten his referral here at Hope, and we were picking him up, and I was assigned to be his program manager. Brian told me he had always dreamed about having his own apartment, but he thought it would never be a reality for him. And that got my brain thinking, because I feel like everybody deserves that independence. And so I went to my supervisor and asked, how do we get Brian into the studio? So the problem about moving Brian out of a housemate situation was he wouldn't have staff 24 hours a day. And that would be the first client at Hope to not have staff 24/7. So it was hard. It was a hard sell. But luckily, Safe and Home had just recently put on a demonstration for all the service providers. And Cheryl kind of stepped in and decided she wanted to go with this option for Brian.
They helped me find this place, which is, I was really excited to have this place. We have a place.
Yeah.
I was so excited.
I think he has gotten to see kind of a new world outside of his little small town, and I think he enjoys that.
Just bring it to be my own self, actually. Here I am, the great husband. I don't know if I'm supposed to fund you. You just create your own meals, sleep in my own bed, and just get up and just do things that I want to do.
It was so exciting to figure out what he wanted to do. And the three main things he wanted to do was get a full-time job, learn to drive, and find a long-term relationship. And so those were goals that we kind of put in place, these stepping stones to work on.
I already know the thing about how you know. I've had it 5 months now. I've never driven a vehicle in my entire life. I've never been behind a wheel. So that's going to be a brand new adventure. I'm looking forward to it. I have the right equipment to be safe. I want to know where I was going.
the GeoCom is always there, and it always reaches me, and it always reaches Safe at Home, and it's just something that we know will always keep us safe.
Hey, Brian, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's up? How can I help you?
I'm
trying to turn around. Oh, you turned around?
Yeah,
what? Let me look at your location. It looks like you're in downtown Tacoma, is that right?
Right.
Awesome. Let me
get
you directions back to
the
bus, okay?
I appreciate it.
I think having services like Safe at Home available is shaping a whole new world for what services could look like. It's up to us as healthcare workers to take that leap and move these services into a new age, a new era, and it's our responsibility to figure out how do we make sure we are providing the highest level of services and making people's dreams come true.
I highly recommend Safe at Home.
I honestly get the chills every single time I see, and Brian is one of my personal people that I was able to bring on service, so it just really hits home with me. If you want to take a couple of minutes or we can talk about it at the end, just tell me some of the things that resonated with you the most about that video, and then we can talk about it. But I'm going to just talk a little bit about the elements of remote support. There are five different elements. I'm going to go through them very quickly individually. The first element, of course, is the person, the individual themselves. And what we do at Safe at Home is we do provide those individualized solutions. It's developed by us through consultation with the person directly and their care circle. We try to create a very, you know, strong learning environment. We want people to use their decision-making skills that sometimes have been taken away from them. We don't ever speak to them directly. We don't say, okay, you know, Susan, it's 10 after 6, go take your medication. What we do is we incorporate that into a conversation by saying, hey, you know, Susan, it's 6:10. What do you normally do at this time of day? Or have you had a chance to take your medication yet? So what we really want them to do is you know, use that frontal lobe of their brain really use those decision-making muscles again. The second element, of course, is our remote support staff. We still are able to offer that human-to-human connection with our individuals, even though we're not in the same room with them, just like we're doing right now. You can see me, you can see my emotion, you can see if I'm mad or if I'm sad or if I'm upset about something, and we can have still a really meaningful conversation with each other and support each other, even though we're not in the same room. We're not here to take, the place of caregivers, because there's definitely a place for them. I mean, we can't, you know, do things like, obviously, meal plan or cook for them or, help with, their hygiene or anything like that. But what we can do is help them with things like medication reminders or keep them safe in the kitchen while they're cooking on their own and things like that. And all of our remote support staff is trained in what's called ACT, which is Acceptance Commitment Therapy. So if someone, for example, is having like an anxiety attack, our remote support staff is trained to be able to de-escalate situations and really help people get through a certain situation. And they really do develop those authentic relationships with people. I've had, you know, the good fortune to be able to go hang out in one of our call center locations up in Northern California. And it was so wonderful just to kind of eavesdrop and see what kind of, you know, things were going on. And it was just so cool to hear people just have really normal conversations with each other about, you know, how the weather was, or, you know, they were talking about television shows, or it was just really neat to see how they really interact with each other. All of our call centers are very extremely HIPAA compliant. It's, you know, key card access only. Everything is recorded. Every interaction is recorded. Every call center is supervised 24 hours a day. And again, we really, really work with them to develop those decision-making skills. So the third element is actually the assistive technology. You saw Brian Brian talking on his tablet. It's one of the ways that we use to communicate with our remote support staff. Again, it does give them the ability to have a face-to-face conversation with someone. You saw Brian use his geolocation device, which is called the Geocom. People use it at work, out in the community. They can also use it even just at home if they don't want to look at somebody face-to-face and just want to have a conversation with someone. We offer things like seizure wristbands, video doorbells, and the medication dispenser you can see on the slide, that we can also couple it with, the medication reminders by the remote support staff. The sensor technology we can put into a home to, remote support specialists are not looking at a screen, like watching a Pac-Man walk and having walked somebody, through their home at all. We don't use cameras unless, of course, it's absolutely requested by the individual. But this gives our remote support staff a really kind of good bird's eye view of what's going on in a in an environment. So it really passively tracks what they're doing, where they are, if they've left the house, and it's typically not the time that they leave the house, we can, reach out to them, reach out to their caregivers, that sort of thing. We can use, heat sensors in a kitchen and put a motion sensor in there as well. So if the heat sensor detects heat and there's no motion in the kitchen, the remote support staff can reach out to that individual and say, hey, Karen, have you recently been cooking? And Karen would say, yeah, I just made macaroni and cheese like a half an hour ago. And they said, well, we're detecting a little bit of heat in the kitchen. Why don't we walk over there together and just see if you maybe left the burner on? So we can keep them independent. They can still cook, but yet still have that safety net of just making sure that everything is okay. And then, of course, everything is just integrated together. The sensor technology speaks to the assistive technology, which helps the remote support staff get a really, really good picture of what's going on in that individual's environment. And then also there are weekly reports. That's the fifth element of what we do. Everything, like I said, is documented. Every phone call, we can document anything and make them individualized to what the care team wants, what the individual wants. Maybe a doctor needs some information. We can completely customize what their care notes look like. We can track things, daily activities. We can track the medication reminders, whether we were able to get through to them or not. We can really do these, and these will be available to the case managers, the family, and the individuals themselves. So this is just a few of the things that we can support. We already talked about medication management, transition. We help a lot of kids maybe after school and or helping them transition from, living at home to on their own. Visitor safety is a big, huge one. We use video doorbells, and we would put the live feed on their tablet so they can actually, if somebody rings their doorbell, they can just go to their tablet and see who's at the front door and actually have a conversation with that person without ever opening up their door. It's just another level of safety, and it's used all the time. It also has a recording capability so that they can actually go back and look at the feed as well. We talked about kitchen safety. Elopement is another big one where we can do things just with door sensors, video doorbells, things like that, seizure management, and things like that. So right now, Safe and Home is in 15 states, and we will be, within the first quarter of 2023, we will be opening 4 more states in Texas, Iowa, Maryland, and Kansas. And we have logged over 635,000 support hours in the last 6 years with people. And so remote support is a service. It's just not a thing. We're not throwing technology into someone's house and saying, here you go. It's actually coupled with, that human connection that we offer and, just giving somebody a new way to be supported. It's, we're all trending towards technology. Look at us today, all on Teams and Zoom together, right? So the steps to remote support are very simple. We do most of the heavy lifting for you. You just identify anyone that you feel would be a good candidate for this service. You reach out to me. I cover the whole entire state of Washington, and we would set up a consultation with the individual and the care team, whoever would want to be involved. Then we would then come up with a proposal that we would submit to the DEA case manager. The case manager goes and gets the approval, the prior approval through the process with DEA. This is all covered, by the way, on the IFS, the basic plus of the core waiver. Also, we work with RCL, Roads to Community Living. Once the approval comes from DEA, then we schedule the installation, and then our client service team kind of swoops in and does a very in-depth assessment with the individual, the care team, the case manager, and really sets up protocols. Okay, if this happens or if the door opens at 2 a.m., you know, what do we do? Do we leave them alone because they're a smoker and they always go out and smoke at 2 a.m.? Or is that something unusual and we would reach out to the care team or the individual themselves? So those types of protocols are put into place, and then we're just, the service starts and we're on our way. So now I'm going to leave it open for some Q&A. Before we do that, I'm going to just put my contact information up there. Please feel free to reach out to me just for questions, or if you have an individual that you think you know would be interested in the service, and also everybody at the Clark County DDA office knows how to get a hold of me too if you want to do that. But yeah, I'd love to leave it open if we have time for some questions. Oops. Get out of here. There we go. Any questions, any comments, concerns? I mean, I'd love to talk about everything.
Hi, Peggy. This is Gabriela Ewing. I love your presentation. Thank you so much for sharing. And this is very exciting. do you have the service for non-DDA clients?
Yes, I mean, we can do private pay. If the individual is not covered under a waiver, we can offer this on a private pay situation as well, yes.
What's the approximate cost of that?
Well, it really depends. I mean, it can be, you know, it can be really anything. If we gave them, let's say, a basic tablet and a couple of hours of remote support where we could maybe give them like, you know, maybe two medication reminders or something during the day, and a tablet and a geocom, you know, that they could take out into the community with them, that's probably averaging about $500 a month.
Okay, thank you.
All included with the, you know, and all of the, by the way, all of the equipment that we put in is all guaranteed. It is, if it's lost, stolen, broken, pawned, whatever, it's replaced, and it's happened. But if we have 100% guarantee, we just come in and replace the all of the equipment, service it, and replace it for no charge.
And I just say this is for the entire state of Washington. You have clients in California, and I hear in some other places.
Yeah, we are actually, well, we do have some clients in California, but they're on private pay, but we don't have the state system set up on waivers yet, with California, but we're in Virginia, Indiana, Ohio, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, I'm looking at my list, I don't know these by heart, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Minnesota, Alabama, Massachusetts, and did I say Wisconsin? And Colorado. So we're, like I said, in about 15 states currently on the waiver program, on the state, you know, state waiver program in those states. But we could, you know, operate on a private pay waiver.
Okay, thank you so much.
Starlight, you have your hand up.
I do. Are these still being paid out of aggregate dollars? I know we're trying to get them moved to a different part of the waiver. I just didn't know where we were at in the process.
Yeah, still it's in the aggregate dollars. We're actually still under Appendix K because the, you know, they haven't given us the end to the pandemic, you know, thing yet. And then once that happens, it's becoming a permanent service as right. Supposedly as of March of 2023. We're still kind of falling under that the Appendix K where it has to be COVID related, but you know, we get very creative. And, but yeah, so it's still, and I'm not sure if it's going to come out with something other than aggregate dollars. The DDA headquarters has not shared that with me yet. So
thank you.
Oh, Susan, you're muted.
I think Susan was saying, Trish, you have a question. Is that right? Do you have language accessibility? So for people that don't speak English or maybe use sign language, do you have the ability to provide other languages or people to help sign?
We do have, they do use a software that can help people with signing, and we do a lot with texting and typing type of communication with people that have hearing inabilities and anybody that can't or even nonverbal people. We work with a lot of nonverbal people, but as far as other languages, you know, we have some Spanish-speaking client services people, but it just can't be guaranteed. Like, I can't say they're going to get a Spanish-speaking individual every time. We're kind of working our way towards that as far as we, especially in the state of Washington, we realize that there are a lot of different languages spoke in the state. We don't have any specific people that I could... You know, but we managed just fine. I mean, we've been doing pretty good with communicating with each other. Anybody else?
Yes. Thank you, Sadie. How long has Safe and Home been in place? I think you might have said at the beginning and I lost it.
Within the state of Washington, we've been here, we were like kind of official last June, so it's been about a year and a half.
But
at Safe and Home.
Yeah. In general.
Yeah. In general, Safe and Home has been in business for over 10 years, but the last six years has been with the IDDD community.
Okay. Yeah. It's so funny. It takes me back to, you know, with cell phones, had cameras, and one of my teaching colleagues was so impressed with kids were out doing community access and traveling and bus training. She's like, yeah, now if they get lost, they can take a picture with their camera and show you where they are.
We've come a long way.
We've come so far,
Even like the Geocom is such a great device because not only can you call it and somebody could, you know, they can use it as a cell phone device. It's just a small little individual device like this, but it has so much capability. And, even the family and, you know, case manager or peer circle can actually text the device because it has its own phone number, and you can ping the location and help them either go get them or you know, call them and get them back home, just like you saw with Brian. Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. That was a whirlwind of information.
Hopefully you weren't drinking from the fire hose, but please feel free to reach out to me. I can provide you with another video and just a couple of flyers if you want to. Trish, if you want that, I can definitely forward that to you.
That'd be great.
A copy of both of those videos.
Yeah.
And some flyers just to, you know, send out to everybody that attended or that couldn't make it.
We'll add it to our website, and then we send out a notification that to everybody that says our website's updated with these resources. So that'd be great. Thanks, Peggy.
Well, I will certainly do that. Thank you so much. I really, truly appreciate you letting me be with you today.
Appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. So, DARPA Health, legislative update.
It is that time again. So, session starts next Monday. We're very excited. As many of you know, in Clark County, we have three new legislators this session, and all the rest are our incumbents. So we're excited to get our new people going up there in Olympia. The governor's budget came out, I think it was around around the 15th or the 16th of December. And it's interesting, you know how we always do our side-by-side for budgets or bills or whatever. There's not one, I take that back. There's one sad face and all the rest are happy faces on the governor's side-by-side budget. Yeah, so that's great. Our state does have quite a bit of funding right now, and we also have quite a bit of need. I have forwarded those to Trish, so she will be getting those out to you. It's quite long, so I'm not going to go through all the details of it, but I will hit a few highlights. Just generally speaking, there's quite a bit of funds to increase rates for providers in many different capacities for nurses. There's some, I'll let Trish talk about the rates for employment providers, but there's also some funding to increase rates for adult family homes and some of the other opportunities like that. They're also trying to get to where the early, the ECAP, the early childhood program, those have more rate increase so that those become more of almost an entitlement program, which would be great because right now we don't have an entitlement preschool in our state. They're looking at bringing on 25 staff to complete eligibility and determinations for DDA. So that would help increase that, I just moved it from one screen so I could be looking at you and reading it, but then it's too small and my eyes are too old, so sorry. There's some new enhanced adult family home pilot projects for specialized family homes just for individuals with IDD. There's some funds that we're not real thrilled about is to take part of the Rainier campus and to upgrade it so that individuals that are stuck in, so that individuals that are stuck in hospitals, that we can act as a short-term transition for people who are stuck in hospitals but no longer requiring medical placement. And so, as you know, in Washington State, we have a huge problem with individuals with IDD being stuck in hospitals because there's not appropriate placement for them in the community, both children and adults. And so, this is actually just to create some of that short-term placement. There's also an issue, we won't go out my soapbox yet. Okay, we talked about early childhood, a 40% rate increase for ECAP, 2,000 slots per year to make progress toward ECAP becoming an entitlement project, money toward the ECHO program. So for those of you that may or may not know, ECHO is that program that I always think about it around autism, but they do it around all kinds of other programs as well in the state, where professionals can get together and work with one another across the state so that they have a bank of brain power to work on specific cases, right? And so, and to really pick the brains of those individuals that are highly skilled in those areas. New benefits through the healthcare authority. There's going to be new benefits will enable Apple Health to provide cochlear implants for 625 adults, which is huge. That's wonderful. Increased reimbursement for the app for applied behavioral analysis services. That's huge. I know I heard yesterday that one of the largest ABA providers in Spokane County is shutting down. And it's going to be dislocating 300 clients in that one county to no longer be able to have their ABA. We were talking about what a ripple effect that's going to have. So having that increased reimbursement is going to be huge. Increased reimbursement for developmental screening. Under OSCI, we've got language access funding to help increase language access. There's funding, this is huge. There's funding to raise the cap on special education. Of course, the cap for our special ed funding has always been at 13.5%. Right now, there's in the governor's budget, right, which is just a proposal. The legislators don't have to accept it or do anything with it. It's just a recommendation. But he put in funding to raise that 13.5% cap in special ed to a 15% cap in special ed funding. That's something that's been needing to be done for a long time. Increase the pre-K special ed multiplier. That's through OSCI. OSCI has increased federal funding. Make sure that federal funding is reappropriated to extend to transition students and to qualified special ed students. To sustain the state's investment in inclusionary practice. Yay. Just one second, please. Sorry, I'm getting over a cold.
Darla, can I share the, are you looking at the ARC smiley face sheet? Can I share that on the screen?
Yeah.
Okay. You'll have to tell me which number you're on.
I am currently on number 30. I'm just breezing through it real quick, trying to hit some highlights. And then I want to go back to the employment so you can go into a much more in-depth conversation about
employment. Sure, thanks.
Okay, can you get it up there? On 30 is the Administrative Office of the Sport. They're looking to get additional funding to continue adding new clients to public guardianship programs. That's huge. When we started that public guardianship program, oh, I don't know how many years ago it's been, but it's really been kind of a logjam because they filled up and we haven't had any new funding to add additional people to those programs. So that's huge. Number 31, study to look at the deficiencies in the physical and program access to court services to create a disability and justice commission. That's huge. Through commerce, all these COMs, this is commerce, right? So looking at the Council to Contract with a BIPOC nonprofit, DD Council to hire, and Gabrielle is the chair of the council, so she can tell you about these. But the DD Council to hire a policy as analyst. Gabriella, do you want to talk any more on those specifically?
Hi, Deva. Thank you for sharing that. Actually, I'm going to share much about it because we are having a meeting tomorrow. We're going through the all the applications, and so far we don't have any updates. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriella, and thank you for all of your service. So they're looking at doing a nonprofit to serve in Kent, to serve culturally linguistic diverse families and persons with IDD for a housing community center, right? Create diverse stakeholder work group to access home ownership and to address disparities among the BIPOC communities. I'm just skipping through some of these. And then the Housing Trust Fund, right? Grants to fund repairs and alternatives to the K-12 schools to improve compliance for ADA and IDEA. That's huge because some of our old schools just really are not, don't have what they need. And then here, number 40, redesign FERCREST to be used as a short-term crisis stabilization. That's huge. And then working with stakeholders to create a 120-bed nursing facility. The nursing facilities have been in the works for a few years, but this is the first time I've really seen where they're looking at taking FERCREST and turning it to that short-term stabilization. That's huge, guys. We've been working on this for, I don't know, how long have I been doing this now, 30 years? Relocate adult training program on the FERCREST campus, so that's going to take a chunk of money to relocate that. And then DSHS may not transfer appropriation for the DD program to any other program or sub-program. Yay. They've got to stay in the DD budget. Now, I will be completely honest. I'm not 100% sure what this very last one means on number 43. Funds appropriated for the Dan Thompson Memorial Developmental Disabilities Community Services account. So last year we got that huge amount, I think it was $50 million, set aside for the Dan Thompson money. And then we were got to where we would get additional Dan Thompson money every year. We wasn't sure what was going to happen with those funds that wasn't used. And we haven't been able to get all of those used, partly in the difficulty in getting those out. So this says that they're being moved to part 8 of the omnibus operating budget. And Gabriella, please, I hope you have more information. Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, and so hopefully this happens. So the DDC requested for the downtown fund not to be only a one-time funding for the state of Washington. So we hope to have continuous funding for people with developmental disabilities in the state of Washington. So hopefully that will take care of that. And so please say yes to your representatives. With double thumbs up.
Yeah, wonderful. That would be excellent if we could get that. I know the request has been $2 million ongoing each year, so that we have an ongoing opportunity for those Dan Thompson dollars. So that's where we're at right now. Session starts on Monday. And of course, you know, first, let's see. So we are in a odd year, so I think the House budget comes out first, and then the Senate budget will come out second, if I'm remembering right. And then we'll have to work together to get collaboration on those. But what's really important for you guys is for Trish to talk about these rate increases for employment providers, and I'm trying to find the number, Trish. You want to go ahead?
Sure, it is in there. I did see it on the smiley face sheet, and we've been having some discussion about this. So we don't know yet what the governor's budget actually did include for the rate increase, and I'm not sure that the state ARC is aware of the level of detail. So what it's sounding like is that the governor's budget did not include the full rate increase that was recommended in the rate study that was provided to the legislature. Now, we don't know exactly what it means yet. So it sounds like DDA is doing some analysis and will be sharing information about really what the impact of what is in the governor's budget will be. And we hope to hear back about that, you know, hopefully this week or next week. So that we can be able to advocate effectively for what we need. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Any questions? Thank you so much, Trish, and thank you so much, Gabriella. You know, there's so much detail in each of these line items here on this smiley face sheet. And you know, it's a good starting spot, but we'll see what the legislators do when they get going. We will be driving up once or twice each month to see our legislators in person. Advocacy Day will be happening every Wednesday. We will not be going to Olympia on Wednesdays. We're going to be doing virtual Advocacy Days and going to Olympia on a different day of the week this year. So that will be interesting. If anyone's interested in participating with us, Trish, I had sent out the Advocacy Day flyer to Trish, as well as our legislative reception flyer. And our reception is, I'm going to have to pull up the, switch my screen here real quick, so I can, because I don't have the dates in my head.
I just posted it, or shared it.
Oh, thank you. There you go. So the briefing is first, and it is, there you go, Wednesday, January the 15th. So the briefing will happen at 2 p.m., and that's going to be held virtually as well as in person, and then the reception is in person. I mean, sorry, the reception is virtually, which actually works, I think, better than in person, because you can have more of a individual conversation. When we were all down in the Columbia room, it was a little loud. So, I encourage you to reach out to your legislators and your connect with them. This is a great week to connect with them. And Susan?
I was just looking at the calendar. You said Wednesday, January 15th?
Yeah.
1-5? So my calendar says January 15th is a Sunday?
Oh, let me look. You were right. It's the 18th. Thank you. Do not share that flyer with anybody. You've got to get that corrected. There you go. Okay. We won't tell you which employee did that one. We'll just say it's very close. Miss Peggy.
Trish, can you share that flyer and all of that information with all of us that are here?
Once we get the corrected flyer, I will share. We're going to post it on our website, and then we send out an email to a broad list of people who are attending the meeting and other stakeholders to let everybody know that it's been updated and that there's materials available there. Darla, I was hoping that you could talk a little bit more about advocacy days and what that's going to look like this year. You said that you're going to be actually going to Olympia this year on another day, but going to be doing virtual advocacy day. Can you just explain that a little bit more?
So I believe, and Gabriella, again, please jump in because you probably know more of this than I do. But advocacy day is is primarily virtually. I think some people will be there in person on Wednesdays. So advocacy day, all the advocates from around the state get together. Usually an advocacy day has a topic, and then we have speakers that speak on that topic, and generally speaking, the topic's addressing a certain bill. So before COVID, you would do that in the morning, and then you would make appointments in the afternoon, and you would go meet your legislators, and it would be one full day. And that was great, and it was wonderful because you would get to Olympia, and there would be advocates from all over the state up there really advocating for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It was amazing. But it was a challenge in that some committees always meet on Wednesdays, and so some legislators were always historically not available on Wednesdays, right? And so now with advocacy days being more of a hybrid and things being more of a hybrid where you can do it online and you can do it in person, that frees us up to be able to go to Olympia on whatever day it is that works for the legislator and be able to set appointments. So the advocacy days is an excellent opportunity to get in, learn more about a specific topic, and each day has its own topic. What's being addressed? Why it's being addressed? Oftentimes we'll have legislators that are our guest speakers on those days to talk about different things. I know there's some incredible bills that have already been dropped in the hopper. Well, they haven't been dropped in the hopper yet because they can't until Monday, but they're ready to be dropped. And it's going to be an exciting year. I haven't looked forward to a session like this for a long time, but everybody needs more funds too. As we know, the thing that's hurting us across the board is staffing issues, right? Whether it's medical or school or employment or supported employment or residential housing, all across the board, we don't have enough staff. No one does. And to address that, we need to up wages everywhere. And so while our state has funds and we're doing okay, there's going to be a lot of places for those funds to go. So stay tuned. It'll be fun. And hopefully it'll be a positive session.
And Darla, I've gotten this question before about what it means when you say a bill is dropped. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. We're working right now with a senator from another community, and I say we, it's the big general we. I don't have much to do with it except I'm on an email chain. A senator from one of the upper communities up in the state that happens to be a Democrat has drafted this bill language. One of our local representatives is writing a companion bill, meaning they're taking the same bill language and they're writing a companion bill. So those two bills will come together. That bill will have twice as likely of a chance to get through. So each of these individuals are writing the bill. They're working in collaboration. Our representative is a Republican. The senator that's a Democrat, we're working together on this DD bill, and then when they drop it, it means they kind of put it into play. They call it the hopper, but it's actually, there's a place you actually go and put the bill, and you drop it into the box that actually puts the bill into play. And so that's what they call, are referencing when they talk about dropping it in the hopper or dropping a bill. And then it goes through a multitude of processes. So it'll start going to committee hearings, and then it'll get testified on, and then depending upon if there's a fiscal note, it'll go to a budget committee after, first it goes to policy committee and then to a budget committee, and it just works its way through the process. And then once it gets through the House, the process on one side, so through the representative of the House side, then it has to go over to the Senate side. So by having a companion bill, such as the one that we're working on this year, it'll have twice as likely of a chance to get through because it's already being worked on both sides. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? It's a lot of fun, guys.
And are you, you know, in years past, you've taken people up to Olympia. Is that going to start again this year, that you'll actually be taking carloads of people that would like to go with you up to Olympia?
Absolutely. Thank you, Trish. When I say we're going to Olympia, that's what we're going to Olympia for, to take individuals who experience IBD, their families, professionals, vendors, anyone who might be interested. We will take you up. We'll do the whole tour guide experience. We'll set appointments with your legislators. We'll help you know what to talk about. And there'll be other people there who are also share your legislators, right? And so it's a great day. It really is a lot of fun, and we go up. We have a good time. It sounds intimidating, but it's not at all. Peggy?
No, I just put my hand up because I want to go.
Oh, yay!
I'm like, please take me. This is my
fun. I'm like, that's coming to me, too. I'm glad to listen. You like, what? Olympia?
I'm here to go. So, I'm calling you.
All right. I'll hold you, too.
You take your own car, then go to your gang kit. Yeah. Okay. So, any questions for the good of the order? All right. Well, it's time to say that we are prepared to adjourn the meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.